I can do a few, but there's going to be signing tomorrow, actually. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Those of you who've been to my talks before know that I try to pack 100-plus slides into 60 minutes. So, I'm starting. They want me to remind you to get your little forms and fill them out afterwards. As nicely as possible. They didn't tell me to say that part. I added that myself. Cell phones off, beepers, noisemakers, CD players, iPods connected to large speakers, all of that stuff. You know, no podcasting from the room or whatever. Booth crawl tonight, 5 to 6:30. IGF and Choice Awards, Grand Ballroom, third floor, 6:30 to 9:15. I think that's all the reminders. And I just dropped a pen, but I don't need it. All right, grammar of gameplay. You're in the wrong room if it's you thought it was something else. This is game atoms. Can games be diagrammed? So I'm going to give like a 5-minute extremely dense recap before we actually get to the content. The first part, of course, is self-promotional whoring. I spent the last year and a half writing a book about why games matter, okay? And I was spending a lot of time thinking about what is fun and why do we play games and all of that kind of thing. And I spent a lot of time during that comparing games to other media, right? Looking at in what ways are they like music, in what ways are they like something else. And if you've read the book, then you know that I actually use dance as an example, right? I use dance as an example. Film is another good example because games are media that involve the combination of many other individual disciplines, right? So, we see here a pretty cartoon of a dancer, and surrounding her, we see that, in fact, to convey dance, we need casting and lighting and costuming and music and staging and all this stuff, right? But, really, at heart, choreography is what dance really is. If you have just the choreography, you can put on a dance. If, however, you have everything else and no choreography, you will not have dance. In the course of writing the book, it struck me that one of the problems with games is that we can't make the difference, the distinction, between the choreography of games and game design. In fact, we call the whole damn thing, somebody's walkie-talkie is here talking, we call the whole damn thing game design. And that's probably what makes it hard for us to talk about. You know, we can't quite pin down what is the formal heart of games. We need something equivalent to choreography in order for us to really talk about game design as a formal discipline, as opposed to the disciplines involved in graphics, sound, even user experience, because costuming, casting, lighting, staging, and music are about user experience, right? We need to be able to talk about games without user experience and talk about them intelligently and formally, and that's actually kind of a tricky problem. Dance, it turns out, didn't have this, even though dance is one of the oldest art forms known to man. It didn't have this for literally centuries. It wasn't until a guy came along named Laban who developed the form of dance notation that I cannot read because it looks like squiggles, that we were able to write down dances. We didn't even have such a thing before. And the result of this is actually that many of the classic ballets of history that you can read about in history books have been lost forever because we didn't actually know how to notate them. So, I'm going to be the second GDC session of the day and perhaps ever to refer to poetry. The secret is not to move, she said, but sometimes you can turn your head away for a minute, then back, as you do to really watch a sunset. And you do this several times. And then you can feel the dark on your eyes like a cold cloth. Lovely little bit of poetry. Dick Allen, Cities and Empires. I actually went to college with his daughter. Poetry, as you know, is intensely formal. Okay? This little bit of poetry can be notated to a fairly well. It happens to be accentual, unrhymed verse. And you can see little X's that tell you what that means. It means it doesn't rhyme. Woohoo! But it's still accentual, which means it's still got, actually, iambs in it. You guys remember your iambs? Yeah. So there's that first line, and it's actually mostly iambic pentameter, but not really, because there's this cool thing called catalexis that is happening in the middle, where a syllable gets dropped out, and it mimics the rhythms of natural speech. And it does this cool thing where instead of going ta-dump, 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 like iambs do, it goes, for a minute, then back. And there's a little reversal in the middle there. That's really slick. It's trochees into iambs to emphasize the meaning of the word. It turns around the rhythm when we say back. That's poetry. That is the art and craft of poetry, right? In fact, he does it twice. Feel the dark on your eyes. There's a hovering accent. That's a place where you're not sure which of those two syllables you're supposed to emphasize. Down here, there's a Pyrrhic foot. That's a foot, that's a basic metrical unit of measurement, where you don't emphasize anything. And then, this is one of the classic all-star poetry tricks, is you do a Pyrrhic foot, la, la, thump, thump, right? And that's called a spondee at the end, like a cold cloth, and even adds in some alliteration. This guy knows his shit, he knows what he's doing, right? So, music. Those of you who can read can follow along. If you are good enough, that's as far as that bit goes. The whole song's on here, but never mind. If you're good enough at reading music, you don't need to hear that. You can hear it in your head, right? That is the point of music notation. That's why it exists. Now, music still has to resort to funky things. Like you might notice that thing says with plenty of swing. When you listen to the piece, it's going, thump, da, da, thump. That swing. Otherwise, it would go thumb, 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 thumb. Like regular, 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 right? So that's a bit of notation where they had to stick in a little bit of extra language. Music actually has lots of forms of notation. 12-bar blues. 1 to 1, 7 to 4 to 1 to 5, 7 to 4 to 1. It's a form of harmonic notation. And then there's tablature, which is yet another form of notation, right? Music's full of ways to notate. Can we notate games, please? Because it doesn't seem like we're going to know what the hell we're doing until we can write it down like this. Because frankly, and I'll welcome a cheer if you agree with me, design docs suck! Yeah. The bad news. I failed at it. So, if you were hoping to hear the revelation from the mount, you know, sorry. I probably should have spent more than 8 months on it. I don't know how many centuries it took to develop notation. So, here's the thing. We have been hammering, particularly in the last 10 years, I think, and I think a lot of these people are in the room, probably, right? We've been hammering on formal design tools, and all of the folks on this list, and many others, right, deserve a lot of credit. And for that matter, there have been a bunch of academics that have been trying to do this too, right? They've been hammering at this stuff. So, here's the bad news. This was labeled as an advanced lecture. I'm going to go over a couple of the concepts here, but I'm going to assume that you know this shit. And if you don't, I'm not stopping to explain it. Is that a fair trade? Yes? Okay, good. I always get complaints that there's not enough advanced lectures at GDC, so I figured, what the hell? All right. MBA. Y'all have heard of that? Mach, Robin, Robert, all those guys, mechanics, dynamics, aesthetics, they wanted, somebody was bad, I hear a phone, yellow shirts, drag them away. They wanted us to look at games on a mechanical level, a dynamic level, and aesthetic level, which is incredibly important, you know, looking at the rules, looking at how we interact with the system, looking at how emotional responses go. Well, guess what? Music notation does not tell you how you should feel about the music. So, this is not going to cover aesthetics. We throw that out. Music does have the little hinting for performance. Get louder here and not and so on. And it calls that dynamics too, which I thought was kind of cute. But the big thing is, even though this is a follow-on to my theory of fun, I'm leaving fun out of it. Because a formal notation system does not tell us whether a piece of music is fun to listen to, or even any damn good. Right? So I'm skipping past that. Katie and Eric, Eric I know is trapped doing rehearsals over in the Choice Awards right now. You know, in Rules of Play, they said, well, there's kinds of rules. There's constitutive rules and operational rules and implicit rules and blah, 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 right? Awesome book. You should go read it. But you know what? Constitutive rules are the only things that matter to notation. Okay? We don't care about the rules as they are printed in the book. Because that's for the players. And we're not here as players. We're here as the writers. We're here as the designers. Right? So, forget those other kinds of rules. Doug Church and Noah Falstein and Hal Barwood, 400 Project, Formal Abstract Design Tools, all that. The problem with this is they're trying to write sentences that explain game design. There are no notation systems that I could find that were based on written language. Rather, they were all new languages. It doesn't mean the stuff isn't important, it's just we're skipping past it. We need to find something that's iconic. Ben Cousins, Sony Computer over in the UK, came up with this word called ludemes, which he's since ditched. But I actually think it's a really important word. It basically means an atomic element of gameplay. The kinds of things we tossed around were, get to the other side. That's a ludeme. You know, it's trying to get fundamental with things. Ben's actually done things like measuring the average length of time people spend in the air in a jump in a platformer that people think has good controls. 0.7 seconds, it turns out. You know, stuff like that, trying to arrive at kind of the empirical basis of this. What notation won't be about? Game maps. Sorry, the game map can be swapped out of a game, therefore it is not notated. Notation is about the things that are irreducible to the game. It's not about math. Yes, it's very important that you know how to build a probability curve for balancing your RPG combat system, but odds are it is working with data and not with the system. So heck with that too. It's not flowcharts and storyboards, because frankly, we don't give a shit about the player's perception of this process. We're interested in how the designer constructed it. I know that sounds totally heretical. Okay, bear with me. Lastly, we're really not interested in game theory, possibility space, that kind of thing. We're interested in the algorithm for the possibility space. How did I start? I started by reverse engineering. Because I'm an MMO guy, I actually picked MMO combat. Because, it's fun enough, okay? So I wanted to start with an example that had reasonable complexity, it was reasonably fun, it has a lot of moving parts to it, so I started with this. We actually started with this because I was working with Rod Humble, who was the executive producer on EverQuest 2, and we sat down one day to talk about why is it that the crafting systems in MMOs aren't as fun as the combat systems in MMOs. And so, you know, one of those moments of inspiration, I stood up and said, well, let's build a little table and see what ingredients are in each and see what's missing, right? It turned out that actually worked, which was kind of funny. So, we need to slay Foozible, the invincible dragon. He's going to be in Murky Dark. I've got my armor, my sword. I fought him before. He killed me. I've respawned. I'm going to hack him to death. He's got vile minions to defend him. I'll have to hack my way through those first. But I've got mystic missiles, so I know I can break through. I'm going to have to time it right, because otherwise my buff will wear out. And even if I kill him, he might not drop the Helm of Holy Hell, which I really want. But, you know, I'm at the right level to get max XP. If I wait one more level, I'm going to start getting an XP penalty. And if I do it too early, it'll kick my ass. And if I die, well, life will suck anyway, because I'll have debt or whatever to work off, right? Fair summary of the, by now actually getting rather boring, RPG standard gameplay. The neat thing is that there's a really clear list of ingredients that need to be in this. And I won't bother listing them here, because I'm going to do that with multiple slides per in a second. The neat thing is that the game is like this, and each session is like this, and each critter is like this, and each swing of my sword is like this, and each step I take as I run away is like this, and each time I throw away the equipment that was just trashed is like this, and so on. It turns out that game designs are fractal, right? You can keep breaking down these 9 pieces over and over and over and over and over again into smaller and smaller bits. So, first we're going to talk about territory or topology. I'm going to make a number of statements. One of the first ones I'll make is, we look at this all wrong. Our notion of what space is in a game is just completely screwed up. What is space? It is exposed information coupled to a game token. Your player is a game token. Okay? It is the operational space for a given asset. And see, I'm going to go all high-flown on you. It's all the vectors of force the asset can apply, and it's all the vectors of force that can be applied to an asset. That means that when you are playing checkers, the space of checkers is the board. And the space of the game of capture one checker is actually a 2x2 space pointing out in a V forward. Right? So you have to start reducing your spaces down. That means that games generally are lying to the player about the space they are operating in. Right? I think that's important. I'm going to run through a couple of examples. Visual presentation has zilch to do with the actual space the game actions are taking place in. Right? We think of an RPG as occurring in a map. Well, that's not true most of the time. In fact, the map is probably lying and saying that it's a world, which we know is a lie. Right? Come on. The other thing is, particularly in computer games, time is also part of the topology. Right? You have a limited amount of time to perform the move of getting out of the way of the pixel that is going to blow you up. That is a spatial limitation on the decisions that you are going to make in a mathematical sense. Let's look at some examples. What is the shape of checkers? I alluded to it a second ago. Somebody, you, in the front row. Yeah, you, because you're looking and taking notes. What is checkers played on?
A square board
with what characteristics? What's the board like, man? Squares. Skip the avatars. Okay, you fail. Move on. What is the board like? Come on.
Yes,
8x8. Yeah, good. Okay, 8x8 squares. No. Checkers is played on a diamond grid, 4x4 with alternating pushed off rows. Right? Or do you guys play checkers differently than I do? I used this example already on Monday, so some of you can probably guess. What famous classic arcade game is depicted by the red tasty donut?
Asteroids.
Asteroids, that is correct. We don't play asteroids on a square field, we play it on a donut. Right? It's a torus, topologically speaking. The one on the bottom, cribbage, actually, as it stands right now, a singular track going all the way to the end. However, you know, I used this example on Monday. You add wormholes to it, and all of a sudden we have chutes and ladders, right? So the topology of a game can actually be mathematically extraordinarily complex, right? The question is, can we notate it somehow? I use this example in the book. I think now it's completely wrong. Okay? So, Space Invaders, you know, what are the differences? Space Invaders, the Galaxian, and Space Invaders, the enemies march, and you had some defenses, but you're moving side to side, projecting force up. Galaxian, they now move side to side and occasionally dive bomb, and you're moving side to side, projecting force up. Tempest, they're emerging out of the center, you're moving side to side and projecting force in. Wrong! Right? Topologically, what is Tempest? Tempest is the same thing played on a Mobius strip. Right? It just scrolls around the edge. Now, we're displaying it in like some weird, I don't know, what's the, like a polar projection of the Earth. Right? But, you know, mathematically speaking, shape-wise, it's the same damn thing. And your programmers can tell you that because I'm positive they implemented it that way, right? Right? And then finally we have the modern scrolling shmup, and you see I indicated the scrolling of the playfield, which is also usually a lie, right? So I was just completely wrong when I made this page. So let's think about fighting games, actually, because I picked that one, it was easier. Rock, paper, scissors is kind of the fighting game. The space in which it occurs. I am here, right? And I have no way of affecting anything beyond the node that is right next to me, which is, you know, you. And we play rock, paper, scissors. 1, 2, 3. Tie. All right. 2 nodes, each of which can point at each other. They are points in space. It is not a space. It is not a continuous Cartesian area. That is the basic fighting game. There are lots of these. Wari is like this, too. Old fighting games said, wow, we don't have a two-node map anymore. Now we have 150 pixels of horizontal resolution. Right? Now, okay, we can now call this space because my kick could reach past a few pixels. Right? All of a sudden we've got space, I'm not standing at a point. There was a vertical plane, but I'm not going to go there right now to keep the talk moving. So, what that means is, all of a sudden, we could call it this. A spatial depiction with 150 points of axis this way, and for now, let's skip the vertical. Which, mostly in those games, was also a lie, but we'll, 8-bit days anyway. The first 3D fighting games weren't. Right? You guys played the early ones? They were still Karate Champ with 3D graphics. Sometimes the camera swooped around, big whoop. From a game design perspective, completely irrelevant. That means they're still notated this way, right? But I remember when Battle Arena Toshinden came out, because it was this weirdo thing, right? It wasn't really 3D space, because wherever you were always in a relationship to the other guy, and this has actually stuck ever since. We always pivot around wherever the other person is. So that's still a 2D axis, only doing this. Except Toshinden allowed you to roll behind people, and actually you could end up getting way offset. So it actually was happening on a plane, just with a fucked up control scheme, right? I mean, you know. So basically, we finally actually had a Cartesian grid. That's nice. Bushido Blade is still the only fighting game that I know of that really let you just run around, right? Finally. All the others are still using Toshinden's goofy control scheme. So, I submit to you, there have only been 5 fighting games in history. From a topological point of view. We have to break the habit of using, to use Katie and Eric's term about, you know, constitutive and operational and so on. We have to break the habit of using the operational version of the playfield to describe what's going on. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to notate shit. Iconic descriptions would force us to examine the space. So that first circle pointing in one direction is a unidirectional track on a board. Any board game where you start in a square and you move square by square and you reach the end, and there is an end and you don't loop around. The looping version is the next one, right, where one arrow, you know, loops around. That's what I came up with. 3D space, true 3D space. The Mobius strip is actually used a lot, go figure. 2D planes, still used a lot. Now here's the thing. We're going to think atomically and recursively. Every atom has its own topology, right? So we'll nest and nest and nest. And that means that you'll need an icon at every atom. And of course, time. I couldn't come up with a pretty graphical way to denote time, so I resorted to putting a little T to indicate turn, or P for determined by your opponent. That would be the example of the bullet speeding towards you. Or, hey, you've got 5 seconds before something happens, or whatever. We need to know that about the space as well, on a really atomic level. Okay, next ingredient in the atom is preparation, which means really flow, but I call it preparation to make an important point. Okay, Chris Crawford, you all read his books, right? You all know who he is. Stubborn guy. Chris defines interactivity as iteration, a cyclic process where two actors alternatively listen, think, and speak. He's right. All games must be perceived as iterative and looping. Okay? Tossing a coin once is not a game. Okay? It's missing all the other elements. Okay? So, I'm putting a stake in the ground and saying it's gone. Sorry. If you disagree with me, you can talk to me after. As we program games, this seems obvious. Okay? Because we put in a main loop and we say now the next turn happens So, my definition of preparation is all prior choices that influence the next atom in the chain. Okay? That means that if I decide to sit down to play chess with Jesper, hi Jesper, then my choice of Jesper as opposed to Brian Green, hi Brian, was a prior choice that influenced the game, my choice of opponent. Choosing to handicap myself in chess would be a preparatory step. More common in the RPG, this was getting my best armor, right? I mean, in checkers, it is all of the moves prior that I made in order to try to trap somebody into the triple jump that I'm going to make, right? Every game challenge we come to, we don't come to it naked. We come to it with prior choices. These go out and out and out and out until we hit the magic circle, right? So handicapping is one of the most common forms of this to adjust skill levels of people. We can define handicapping, and I'm going to try to pin down a lot of the words that we toss around like candy. Handicapping can be defined as any form of preparation that comes from outside the topmost atom in a game. Okay? And we will get to showing you an atom eventually, I promise. We can call the topmost atom the magic circle, by the way, for those of you who are into the ludology side of things. All games are sequences of challenges, so all prior moves are also examples of preparation. Here's the thing. A lot of challenges in a game are risk-free. Picking the right armor to slay the dragon carries some risk. Dragging the armor into the equipment slot is pretty low risk. Moving the piece in chess is low risk. No risk. We take for granted you'll be able to do it. I suppose there could be a variant of chess where you have to flick it into position, and if you don't succeed, then it dies or something. And in fact, somebody made action chess. You guys played that? It is exactly that. It is action chess where you have to drag the pieces as quickly as possible, and if you miss, then you lose. But those challenges, even though they entail no risk, those obstacles, those goals to achieve, are still atomic. They still count. We have to be aware of that. It becomes important later. So that means, all of a sudden, that we can start thinking about how pieces of games fit together. You can think of games as sequences of events. Now, frankly, this is exactly what I said you shouldn't do, which is look at games from the experiential point of view. Because there are often game events that are order-dependent, like the example in crafting of dragging items into slots and hitting the combine button. That's actually, you know, one challenge per item, plus the challenge of hitting the combine button. Okay? But sequenced events is actually a lie. Because it's more accurate to say that games are nested events. A given challenge is part of a meta-challenge, which in itself embodies multiple smaller challenges, and so on down the line. It's more important to think of it as fractal or recursive. We can also think of games as being multiple challenges undertaken at once, right? Often you have a choice of what challenge am I making, or even I'm doing both, right? And sometimes these are higher level and lower level challenges. So, you know, you are doing both pressing the combine button in parallel with crafting an item. And in fact, you know, hitting the button completes both of those tasks. Let's think about this. Moon Patrol, from that chain point of view, you know, tanks moving across the landscape, and it can shoot up and forward, it can slow down or speed up, it can't stop, it can jump, enemies roll, scroll towards it, drop bombs, you know. That's a very normal way of looking at the game. Whoops, wrong way. But you can also look at Moon Patrol as get a high score is one game, within which is complete a level, within which is defeat one enemy, such as a jump, because the hole is an enemy, within which is time the button press correctly, because that is a different challenge than defeating the hole, right? Because Moon Patrol, simplistic game, there's only one way to beat the hole, but there are, in many games, multiple ways to defeat the challenge of a given enemy, right? And whichever way you choose will likely be a challenge of its own. Even the simplest games, and I'm going to come back to checkers a lot, tend to have parallel elements. In checkers, you've got an atom that is removing all the enemy pieces, right? That is the magic circle of the game. That's the outer boundary. Within it is remove one enemy piece, and you're going to have to do that 12 times. Or set up a defensive move, or set up a future attack, or entrap somebody into a forced jump, right? And these things can be happening in parallel. So even simple games have parallelistic elements. I keep hitting the wrong button. So all of a sudden, we can start trying to hook shit together. Let's look at Galaxian, right? It was played on 224 by 256 screen, but that's a lie, because the 256 was actually a measurement of time. You couldn't move there. All it really meant was how long does it take for the bullet to reach you. We displayed that graphically, but it wasn't space, right? That's what it was. So we have a 224 strip with a time index of 256, variable 256, in which the objective is to get the highest score. Now, You have two parallel challenges happening there. One is kill an enemy, and the other is don't get hit yourself. Don't get hitting yourself. The space on it is really moving one pixel to each side, and a time, which can't exceed probably around 250. I don't think the critter's shot for much higher than that. And then there's kill enemy, which actually is not a time-limited challenge. You can stay on one level of Galaxian as long as you want, as long as you keep from getting killed. Killing the enemy has the challenge of lining up the shot, right? And then after that, it has the challenge of pressing the fire button. I've notated the fire button with, you know, the little bar end for music and in red because, you know, the timing it requires some skill. But we assume that completing this electric circuit is a given, right? It's like, yeah, we'll take that for granted. Similarly, don't get hit. Okay. What's your challenge? Moving. But we'll assume that there's no skill involved in literally activating the muscles in your arm for the joystick. Okay? That's the point at which it stops. Every single game is going to recurse at least once, because every game is built out of iterative challenges within some kind of Uber challenge. And we'll usually say the Uber challenge is winning the game, right? Generally. Some games, we can't identify one Uber challenge. And those things get called MMOs, will write games, or directionless. Okay? That's something to keep in mind. All of a sudden, you know, if we're able to arrive at a decent orthography for notation, we'll actually be able to spy those and point to why, and I think that would be kind of cool. All good games can be played on a parallel level. And I'm going to actually define the word breadth here. Okay? When we looked at Galaxian and we saw those two parallel tracks, that is how broad the game of Galaxian is. We now can actually graph broadness of a game. Isn't that kind of cool? And if there's only one of those, well, the game was probably going to be a simple little thing in Shockwave, right? It's going to be something very simple and basic. All games are perceived sequentially, but they're not played sequentially. When you play Galaxian, you are actually thinking atoms up and atoms down all the time, right? When you're playing Moon Patrol, you're dodging a bullet while also thinking about the second pit forward, right? And we don't play games sequentially. We should not design them thinking purely sequentially. It's a mistake. They don't work that way, and people don't play them that way. So why we think we can do them with storyboards after this process now makes no sense to me, because that's not the way they're played or made. So we actually can pin down some stuff if we can actually arrive at graphing this stuff. We now know what depth means. It means exactly, literally, how many nestings do you have? How many challenges within another challenge within another challenge? Right? So you get to Street Fighter, where it starts going really broad with number of moves, and each one involves a ton of individual timing challenges, until to pull off some uber combo, you've got a nested thing that's 40 deep? Yeah, no wonder they call it a deep fighting game. Duh, it's deep. We can actually look at it, which is kind of neat. We also know how big a game is. We always say, oh, that's a small game. Well, now we can literally count. Well, how many atoms do you need to do in sequence? And that's its size. And we can say, oh, that's a small game. So it's kind of nice to have finally, you know, now when I throw these terms around, I actually mean something. Which is kind of neat, because I've gotten sick of arguments on the blogosphere, which I know you've been reading, about whether a given MMO is deep or broad. Now I know! It's kind of cool. Now, atoms always have to have a failure state link. Okay? It's got to. You have a given challenge, one of the outcomes is not fulfilling it within the bounds. That might be accomplished by walking away from the game of checkers, okay? But it's there. Even if that is just the opportunity cost of not having actually done the move. So moving a piece in checkers and failing to capture something is actually a failure state, because your challenge is capture something. All you've lost is an opportunity, right? You're not hurt or penalized by it, except insofar as it's now preparation that went into everything previous. That's because if an atom involves risk, it's got to have, you know, risk. I mean, you know, choice A and choice B. Risk implies at least two results in a probability scale. So that's why you're going to see at the very end, if it fits in the time frame, I'm not going to consider moving a checker piece to be an atom, because there's no risk in it. Then comes core mechanic. I really didn't finish Core Mechanic. That's because Core Mechanic is a bugger like this guy. He's really hard to pin down. Chris Crawford says verbs. Sid Meier says choices. A lot of people say conflict. I think verbs is right. Verbs is the right way to think of it. Verbs are the nucleus of every atom. In fact, I'll go so far as to say, if you have an atom that you're attempting to define, a little gameplay element eluding, and you find yourself qualifying that verb, or having two verbs in it, you're not done. You haven't really looked at the game this close. I got this from Game Design Workshop. Some of the authors might be in here. Capture, chase, race, alignment, rescue, escape, forbidden act, build, explore, solve, outwit. These were outlined as objectives in a game. Not really useful to us from a notation point of view, because it's not atomic enough. Solve, Alignment ignores the topological element. It's a list of objectives, so they didn't really mean this. It includes operational assumptions like rescue. I'm sorry, rescue does not belong in a formal notation system, because rescue is fiction, right? And fiction is not going to be in a formal notation system. You know, when I started, I don't pretend to have an exhaustive list, but I ended up with things like remove all, continue to exist, remove one, intersect something with a vector of force, which is what a checker's jump is, you know, move to, touch, and in the end, the bottommost atoms are pretty much all press a button. Okay? In video games, anyway. Let's look at Quake. I mean, I need to run around a corner, jump into the air, line up my shot, headshot him, enjoy the splatter, right? You break it down. Running is determine direction in 3D space. There's probably a stack of atoms down that path. And then pointing, right? And then applying the vector of force for moving, right? You know, because I'm pushing a token, which is my guy. And then jumping adds all of the physics involved in that, which there's a whole stack of challenges with. And then I gotta aim. I'm gonna line up on I don't know, I need a victim that isn't in this side of the room. So, you know, I'm gonna line up on Dave Rickey. And I used this example before. Now the topology isn't 3D, it's 2D. My preparatory steps defined how big a target he was. I got close, he's a real big target. I got far away, he's a real small target. Right? But really, it's about a problem of clicking on a point in 2D space. The topology is completely different. I'm playing the same game as popping bubble wrap. Right? You know, on those little web-based things. You know, pop, pop, same thing. Headshotting is timing, pressing a button, and the splatter is fiction. So, you know, doing that little bit of Quake is actually kind of complicated. There's a lot of stuff that goes into it. In the end, the most basic atoms end up involving a UI action. If you haven't drilled down all the way to the press the button bit, you haven't finished diagramming your game. And to me, this was like this shocking revelation, because I've been trying to train myself to think of UI and player experience first, but in a literal notation sense, they're last. They're the ultimate final little thing. And this is why the sequential way of thinking about it is kind of wrong, because it means you're starting at the bottom and going up. And that means, you know, if there are branches, you have to double back, and it keeps you from thinking clearly about what it is you're stacking together. Another way to think of it, you know, the fundamental atoms will be the ones with no skill and no risk of failure, such as physically picking up the checker piece, or a verb outside the magic circle, right? A verb, an action, or whatever, that is outside the formal bounds of the game. So this means that, you know, should we succeed at notation, we'll be able to see by looking at an atom, hey, look, there's too many choices nested in this atom. Players won't know what to do. It's probably even a hard number. It's probably Miller's number, actually. We can probably look at one atom and say, ooh, there's 9 possible things to do right here. 9 branches? Players will get lost. And we'll be able to do this because we sketched some shit on a napkin. I'd like to be able to do that. We can also tell if a game's too hard to learn. Oh, look, it branches too much. There's too many sequential things going on. And the graph is lots of things stacked in parallel. Ugh. You know. People can't predict tons of branches out into the future. And probably psychologists could actually tell us what that number is. Of course, the brain's sneaky, right? So a 64-way joystick, if you diagram it really, is going to have, you know, 64 nested things. But the nice thing about that is the brain says, those are all basically the same. All we're changing is the vector direction, right? So those kinds of things are okay. We'll need to be careful about how we think about it. So look at chess versus checkers, right? Chess, 8x8. You move the piece. Every single damn piece has a completely different topology in chess. And then there's a physical movement. You look at checkers, capture all pieces in the 4x4 diamond, which is capture one piece in the 2x2 until you get kings, but we won't go there. Physical movement. Checkers actually, all of a sudden, has a more complex diagram, because checkers, if played properly, has forced jumping. And all of a sudden, creating a forced jump is an alternate move, right? It's a different verb. Then, why is chess harder and deeper? Because of all those pieces. Now, those are abilities. Those are choices. They are tools in your toolbox. They are magic spells. Okay? Each of those pieces is actually a verb. They're an action that happens to be embodied in a token. They behave differently. Each of them has their own topology because of their positioning on the overall board. And you get to pick which one to use. But since they're all contained within the same atom, I don't consider them to be individual atoms. For one thing, they're fungible assets. You use them up, you acquire more, you know, the cards in the card game, you swap them out. So they're something else other than the kinds of things we've had before. You know, they're checker pieces, chess pieces, spells, attack moves, movement directions, buttons to press. Anytime we say, I can do this with that, you know, we're identifying a tool. So if topology is the space and the atom's nucleus is the challenge, then we're actually identifying tools we can use to surmount the challenge in a given situation. Even simple games give us multiple tools. Force jump in checkers. Now, every piece is the same, and they have substantially similar topologies. Chess offers us, you know, how many pieces are there in chess? I forget. It offers us that many different pieces with different characteristics of movement and different topologies. So in the end, chess turns out to be deeper because checkers has two, jump and move, and, you know, jump and capture, force jump and capture, and chess has all of the pieces. Six, thank you. This gives us a definition of how complex a game is. Like a hard, firm mathematical definition, which I like. And again, this is probably subject to Miller's number, which is probably why I couldn't play Total Annihilation. Which brings us to content. Think about pole vaulting, okay? I'm not going to run down this, but here's pole vaulting. It's actually very deep. You can see that just by looking at it. But the final thing in pole vaulting, the iteration involved in the challenge, is actually raising the bar, right? Raising the bar is the definition of content. Doesn't that make it easy? RPGs, we have monsters. So the characteristics of content is it exists within the topology. It doesn't define the topology. It exists in the topology. They aren't verbs. They're acted on by verbs. They might use verbs, but that's a different issue, right? They're not nouns. They're adjectives, which was another bizarre revelation for me. They're descriptive characteristics. That is what content is. When we say we need to build a new map, we are not creating a new challenge to surmount in the game. We are changing the descriptive characteristics of the challenges of navigation and so on, right? The challenge that is facing us is still navigation, so we haven't changed that. We haven't changed the mathematical nature of it. What we've actually changed is just the descriptive characteristics of it. So now I know what content is, which is kind of cool. Pieces in chess are not content. Adding more pieces to chess is not going to give us more content in chess. The map in a platformer is content because the topology is what you need to overcome, right? Not the map. Other players in Counter-Strike, and this settles another massively multiplayer debate that comes up, are content. Because they are descriptive variations on the challenge of getting killed or not. Because they behave slightly differently based on statistical variance. And that is what content is, statistical variance. Which brings us to skill. And 15 minutes. If you go back a bit, I said that nesting ends when there's no skill involved in executing a verb. Now I referenced risk. If you go back to Epstein, it was referenced in Game Design Workshop. I did not read the primary source, my bad. Actually, it was rules of play. Never mind. You know, there's guaranteed outcomes, and then there's uncertainty, and in games, by and large, both those suck. Right? We use them as tools, but both of them suck. It's really about risk, which is assessment of probability within a given atom, right? So that's when nesting ends. That means skill lies in the assessment of risk. And I've made the statement, it is a cardinal sin in game design to pile in too many atoms that do not require skill. Duh. I mean, that sounds like brain dead obvious. But let's look at that crafting example I mentioned. So you go to craft in World of Warcraft, let's say. You go and your objective is crafting. Okay, you're going to make something. Great. First, you have to harvest something. And that is a challenge in itself. Then you have to actually craft the thing. And then you either get rid of it or you sell the thing. And getting rid of it in one way or another, you know, that goes down a whole road, so I'm not going to bother. Now, harvesting, you can either kill, and that one really goes deep, right? Or you can just find it. Which in WoW, actually, you know, the finding is the challenge. The actual picking up of the thing is not. That's where it actually ends, right? I hope you've all played WoW. Because if not, my example will go by you. Not all MMOs are this way. This is WoW's diagram. The selling is also interesting because pricing is actually the challenge in selling, right? And finding somebody in here. And actually, there's a lot of people in other MMOs, you know, heck, there and Second Life and Galaxies and lots of other games where that's like a huge part of the game, right? But crafting itself consists of dragging and combining, neither of which requires skill. Two reds in a row, bad. It really is that simple. Never put two reds in a row. Now, what WoW does is try to make the dragging as easy as possible, which is highly laudable. Right? Do that. If you're going to have two reds in a row, which kind of sucks, minimize it. Right? But, you know, if we wanted to make crafting deeper, those would be what we'd change. We'd try to make those have skill required. It wouldn't be dragging. It would be a mini game like in Puzzle Pirates. So never link or nest too many base atoms or your game will suck. And we can actually see it in red and blue. Then comes variable feedback. There must be more than one possible outcome for completing an atom prior to executing the next atom. Always, always. Because if there isn't, then it's a no-skill, no-risk atom, right? It'll be a red. It's a leaf. It's an end point. Now, this manifests lots of ways. The loot might not be the same every time you kill the dragon. You might not drop the helm of holy hell. Your target might jink left instead of right after you lined up the shot. That's variable feedback. You don't know which way he's going to go. You might have captured the checker but set yourself up for a double jump. Oops. Variable feedback, right? There are different outcomes that can happen to the choice you chose to make. Now, these might be outcomes that affect topology, like moving, affecting assets. You might gain or lose an asset. Affecting your opportunity. Oops, I made my move. It was the wrong move, but my turn's over. I can't go back and change it. It might affect content by changing the statistical profile of the assets. But look at this. This is the end of many, many kids' games. You've got to roll an exact number in order to get into the end square, right? This is put in as a mechanism of getting people to kind of balance out, let the kids catch up to the guy who pulled ahead. Success is popping the game. Failure is just an opportunity cost loss. And it just loops back to itself, and your challenge remains. Land exactly on the exit. The most basic sort of variable feedback is your opponent's move, which we shouldn't forget includes all of the little critters in Galaxian moving and firing, right? The computer is your opponent there. Sometimes you can force an outcome, but usually the opponent's move is also a calculation of risk rather than certain, meaning we don't quite know what the computer is going to do. If we do, then bad game design, right? Because it means the atom no longer has risk to it. That means that all games are turn-based, which is nice to lay that to rest. The question is whether the atom is playing the same game you are, as the opponent is. Often they're not. In checkers they are. In Fox and Geese or Galaxian they're not. So some of them are symmetrical, some of them are asymmetrical. But either way, you get to do an atom, the opponent gets to do an atom. Now, you can have feedback loops where the opponent doesn't get to do a move. I call those imperatives. That's like triple jumping in checkers. You had a particular variable outcome that lets you do it again and do it again. These are also combos in a fighting game, right? Which is interesting, because feedback loops, you know, there's positive feedback loops and negative feedback loops. Mark LeBlanc talks about this a lot. Triple jumps for you are positive. Triple jumps, if they did it to you, are negative. Now, the thing is, I mean this literally in the diagram. You can see these, right? I'm not talking about the kind of feedback loop where, you know, power increments and so on. We can actually see that, because if a diagram is looping back to itself in the atom, in the move, then it's a good loop. And if it's popping back to the previous atom, it's going to be a feedback loop where, you know, the guy can capture and capture and capture and capture and capture and capture and capture. This is an unbeatable combo in a fighting game. He'll keep running this loop, completing every objective until he completes the capture all objective, and then the game ends. Oops. Positive feedback loop. That means if we diagram this way, we can actually see this stuff and catch it. Now, varying reward, you know, it might change because of the topology. My best example is this. You get to the last row and checkers or chess, right? So there's subtleties here to the variable reward that I haven't figured out how to notate. Why have variable reward? Well, behavioral psych says random reinforcement schedules, hops, and blah, blah, blah. Cognitive science says variability better than predictability, right? My answer is because I don't want my diagram to be all red. I want it to be lots of blue. Only the leaf atoms should be red, if possible. That will be the best game design. And if there's lots of atoms in the middle that are red, then my game design has problems. Obviously, need to tune. Can't have no feedback. At the minimum, pretty much every game gives you updated information as to topology. That would be the screen you see or the board you're playing on, right? So there's always informational feedback back to the player. A game that does not give you, you know, data back of the variable feedback will suck, right? I mean, and that should be taken as a given. This does lead to the mastery problem, which is the positive feedback. Any loop that you make that trends towards certainty is going to be bad, right? What I couldn't figure out is whether we could see this in the notation. This way of soccer makes sense. We have abilities, which is variable A. You know, your objective is score a goal. You kick the ball, you score, you go back, right? We would never, ever, ever say, every time you score a goal, I get to steal one of the members off your team. Right? Bad loop. Because adding abilities at every loop is stupid. Right? And, you know, it's a game that will tip, like, really quickly. Dodgeball actually has that mechanic, though. But look at how you diagram dodgeball. There's a negative on one line, and there's a positive on a different line. There's a variable outcome of the guy catching the ball, and all of a sudden he can bring somebody back into the game. Right? And the loop is avoided, and we can see it here. So, all of these things lead me to think that there's a grammar. We have grammatical rules here. What we don't have is orthography. We don't have a way to write this grammar, right? We don't have a spelling. In music, classical composers were not allowed to make use of the power chord. It was disallowed. It's called parallel fifths. In games, we have degenerate strategies and exploits. When you read music notation, if you're good at it, which I wasn't enough in music theory class, you could see parallel fifths and octaves. You could see them, and the teacher would come and mark them in red and say, "Ding, and you're bad." We should be able to find, you know, money exploits if we have a notation system, because we'll be able to read them, and if we know how to read it well enough, we'll see it. Likewise, I would hope we'd be able to see emergence, right? Now, all of this, I mean, this sounds ridiculously frou-frou, right? I'm aware of that. Because, you know, saying the words rhythm game is a lot easier than trying to notate a rhythm game. So, you know, I cannot imagine right now actually designing a game this way. I confess, this whole talk has been a fraud. But on the other hand, very few composers actually compose just by using notation. Any more than designers design games just on paper, right? We iterate, we rely on our experience. Notation's mostly for capture and analysis and sanity checking, right? That's really the virtue of it. And that would be, you know, when we decide to spend $15 million based on a stack of paper 2.5 inches high, you know, I kind of wish we had that. What is that? $10 million an inch. So I don't have an orthography for you, right? So I lied. But I do have a heuristic, right? We don't have musical notation, but we do have, you know, the concepts of pitch and a framework, because we can look at links and feedback loops. And now I at least have more of a vocabulary. I know what I mean when I say cheating. I know what I mean when I say game is deep, and I know what I mean when I say this is the play field, right? Because I have a different lens, because I broke it down this way. Here's the thing. The concrete piece of advice for you, though. You ready? Copy down this checklist. It does work. I've tried it. A game is built of nested challenges. Look at any given game system in your game and ask these questions. Do you have to prepare? Does it make a difference how you prepare? Ask yourself that. When I go to do this move, does it make a difference what I did before? Can I prepare in more than one way and still succeed? Does the place where this challenge happens matter? Can I describe this challenge with one verb? Can the verb be modified by adjectives? Meaning, can I make content for this verb that makes a difference? Okay, not just any old content. Content that actually makes a difference. Can I make a choice about how to deal with that challenge? Better yet, at higher levels of the game, do I have to make interesting choices about how to, do I have an array of abilities that I can use? More than one option. Is there skill involved in using this option? Right? Assuming it's not pressing a button. And does it matter how it comes out? If any of those are no, your design is broken. That was useful to me. Because we were able to go and change EverQuest 2 crafting. Because we saw, you know what? The combining step and the waiting tick, tick, tick sucks. Because it flunked four or five of these things. So, no grammar, but that might be useful. Game Illuminati guys helped a lot with this. Rod Humble. Here's my challenge to you, though. I don't know how many people it took to develop music notation. How much effort it involved or how long it went on. And there's, like I said, there's a half dozen forms. But my challenge, I guess, and my question to the industry is, can we actually give this a shot? So email me your diagrams, okay? And I'll put them up on the Theory of Fun website. And we can see whether or not we can actually figure out what the hell it is we're doing. Because I think this might be useful. And as a starting point, I offer my really freaking confusing version of checkers. This is the best I've come up with, right? Notation enclosed inside a box, showing recursion by boxes inside boxes doesn't work. I don't know what does, but there's got to be something there. I'm showing popping out of the magic circle with a little hollow circle on the left side. I'm using red arrows right now to notate failure states and blue arrows to notate positive variable outcomes. But, this doesn't do it. This isn't it. But in the process of going through this, I've become completely persuaded that there is a way to do this. And that I don't know when, 150 years from now, somebody will be able to jot down checkers on a napkin, look at it and go, you know what, that's a pretty damn good game. I can see it, just like that. And if we do that, this conference might be really different, and I think that could be really kind of exciting. So, I leave you with that challenge. We have 1 minute and 33 seconds for questions. Not that I'm going to have answers. What do I think of Christopher Alexander and, all of his pattern stuff? Yeah. Where grammar and orthography are the same thing. I do think they are the same thing. When I say orthography, I literally mean in the sense of, the orthography of notating an accent on something, right? I mean, I'm literally speaking in terms of how do you write it.
So. Hi. These kind of diagrams would become even more difficult to understand if there were seven layers and so on.
I can't hear you.
Is this better?
Yes.
Is this good? The diagram here, if you have a really complex game, it would be really difficult to understand. And you were saying before that rescue didn't make it as an atom because it was content or something. Mm-hmm. But couldn't rescue and these things be good as handles or names for some of these things so you can collapse them and chunk them in different ways?
Sure. I do think that it would be valuable and useful in notation. For example, you probably would have something like a summary word like rescue that maybe you just say, now go see this other diagram,
yep.
Right? But the important thing is don't look at the challenges. Rescue is probably, let's look at rescue and say defender, okay? Rescue and defender is not rescue. It is intersect the ship sprite with the person sprite, right? Rescue is some nice anthropomorphication we're putting on it.
Yep.
So I think it's important that we realize what the actual things we're working with are. Rather than the dressing. I'm not trying to minimize the dressing. You know, I've talked enough about that dressing, incredibly important, central to how everybody perceives games, etc. But, you know, a composer makes certain assumptions about how the symphony player will be dressed and how nice their violin will be and so on. We need to be able to make assumptions that the dressing will come later, right, later in the process.
Okay, thanks.
Can some of the recursion be player learning? If you read the book, which is available at the GDC bookstore for a low, low price, and I'll be autographing tomorrow, you'll know that I think that all of games are player learning experience. Every atom is a player learning experience. Each one is a cognitive challenge to surmount. So, yeah, of course. Jesper. Yes, that is why, so the question is, you know, tic-tac-toe can be notated both, you know, you can play tic-tac-toe exactly as it is, but you can also play tic-tac-toe as essentially a magic square game of adding up to 15, each move is a number incrementing. Marc LeBlanc likes to use this example a lot. And it's really hard to play when you're playing the magic square game, even though it's the same thing, right? So the question is basically, you know, the experience matters a lot, right? It matters a lot to the fun and the enjoyment. I agree. I don't think that the notation system is ever going to quite capture everything. So if you play guitar, for example, tablature captures about half of what you are actually doing on a guitar when you are playing. But it's still a really useful half to have. And I guess that's all I would say. I'm not, you know, like I said, I told you up front, I'm not coming with all the answers, right? There's no doubt in my mind, there's something valuable there, but actually does it do everything? No. And I don't think music notation does everything either. I don't think any notation does that I can think of, actually. JC? Cheating is using a verb that is not inside the atom. It's actually really straightforward. Really, really simple. That's what I like about this, is that it makes a lot of those words really concrete all of a sudden. It's like, I can see the cheat, duh, right there. So, I can barely see you because of the light. Yes? You. You know, go. So the question is, if I can summarize, it seems like we hope we can see depth and emergence and so on using this notation system, but go probably has a really simple notation, and therefore maybe the notation concept is flawed in the way I've set it up. I was thinking about Go last night, and to be honest, I was wrestling with that very question. The thing about Go that's really interesting is the assets you are working with include the assets you've already placed, and each of them is applying vectors of force. So actually, Go gets deeper every turn until it gets really freaking deep, because there's so many assets at play that the topology starts getting really complicated. I tried diagramming Go last night, and I couldn't figure out a way to do it. So that's your homework. Yeah, that's a massively parallel game, right? And some people find Grand Theft Auto to be directionless. And this was another thing that I was wrestling with how to notate. I'll use World of Warcraft again as an example. Actually, all the MMOs these days do it. You know, you've got a ton of parallel atoms there. And people find that confusing, which is unsurprising, right? You know, we find games accessible when there aren't very many parallel atoms available at any given time. But, you know, we cheat by making them, one of them, really visible by putting a red exclamation point or whatever the hell over the head of a quest guy, and that's how we lead you anyway. So we make one atom, like, more important than others, right? Another mechanism we can use, I'll use MMOs again. MMOs have zillions of different activities. Grand Theft Auto, same thing. Zillions of different activities. You can go off and do all of these things. But a lot of them are contained within an overall atom that has a goal. And it's like there are choices that don't contribute towards that goal, so we tend to do them less, right? The power gamer says, well, I'm trying to complete this challenge here, right? Let's say it's making it to the next neighborhood in Grand Theft Auto, and I've got all of these different challenges I can tackle, but only two or three of them actually work towards that, right? Work towards the atom in the level above. So it's kind of like they are choices, but they're less important. I don't have a way to notate that either. That's your homework.
Okay. Why are you using the word atoms
calling them what?
Goals.
Yeah. I call them atoms because atom used to, before science made it obsolete, used to mean indivisible. I'm not dividing them, I'm nesting them. Which, yeah, picky, why don't you? Again, blinding in the light there. Do I think this could be reverse engineered from software? If you had the source code, okay. So that is your PhD dissertation. Jesus. Damn. All right, is nobody over there? Yeah.
So all these notation systems are on a 2D plane. Consider notation systems that are not on a 2D plane. Are there analogs in other notation systems?
Most notation systems have traditionally been in a 2D plane, some exceptions. Hypertext notation is not traditionally done in a 2D plane. It actually makes use of recursion and the concept of containment as well. Actually, you probably could do this within story space, for example. Story space would probably work well as a notation tool for this. But for me, anyway, part of the goal would be something you could sketch on a napkin. I think that's important, actually. I think it's a good requirement to have. If I'd had another 8 months for this talk, I probably would have built a software prototype of a notation tool. Because actually, I don't think it would be that hard to build something that at least forced you to, kind of like, you know how, and I hate this, but you know how like Final Draft and things like that force you to consider structural questions because they force you to look at certain, you know, formal elements of things? I actually think that would be a really useful tool, right? Because it, you know, if you're filling out your atom and it says, that verb isn't on my list because it's just not basic enough, dude. You have to make a new nesting thing here. That would actually be useful, I think, to people. So, Yeah, that can be your homework to write the tool. We are 10 minutes over, and I am due somewhere else. Thank you so much. I apologize that it was so out there. Oh, yes, please fill out the little forms. The fives are really cute. They love to be encircled.
Are there no